From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. According to the National Institute of Health, about 40 million Americans suffer from sleep disorders. They include sleep apnea, insomnia, narcolepsy, and restless legs syndrome. But there are still many misconceptions about sleep. I don't know, that song always makes me drowsy. Santos and Johnny, Sleepwalking. Joining me to talk about sleep and sleep disorders, Dr. Sarah Stoltz, Medical Director of the Sleep Program at the Swedish Medical Center. Thank you so much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And you might have a question for Dr. Stoltz. If so, you can call this number, 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. It's toll-free, 800-289-5869. Write to us, conversation@kuow.org. You're the doctor of sleep. Have you ever had a sleep disorder yourself?
Well, I think everybody's had a bad night's sleep. Mm-hmm. Probably I first became really aware of the problem when I was a resident, because you'd work every third night or every fourth night, be up all night. We got really, 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 really sleepy.
There's something, seem to be some work schedules almost designed to cause sleep problems.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of that in the transportation industry now, too, with schedules to, like, if you're a, say you pilot a tugboat and you have to be there at the time that they need the vessel to be brought into port or whatever, it's not dependent on when you wanted to sleep. It's when the work has to be done.
Has any of the science, the medicine about sleep disorders and the problems it can cause seeped into the work world? Are people modifying schedules at all to take into account that, say, a resident at a hospital might not be in peak shape if they haven't had the chance to sleep enough?
Yeah. Well, since I did my training, they've actually made rules that people can't be working for as long as we used to do. So there's been some restriction on that. And if you look at the pilots, for example, they have a certain number of hours that they can fly before they have to rest. Look at schools also. There's a big movement about changing school start times to be more in keeping with the natural circadian rhythm of teenagers, where they, you know, they like to stay up late and sleep late, and they learn better if they're able to sleep like that.
I think there's a lot more awareness about some of the sleep disorders that are out there. But when I see this number from the National Institutes of Health, about 40 million people, do you think everybody who has a sleep disorder knows it?
No, no, definitely not.
Yeah?
Yeah, you know, if we want to talk about the most common sleep disorder that we see in the sleep center, which is not necessarily the most common thing that the man on the street is experiencing, but about 10 years ago or so, they published a study that sleep apnea, 80 to 90% of people with sleep apnea have not been diagnosed. That's huge.
So they just have some vague feeling that they're tired all the time, but they don't know why.
Right. And in our society, sleep deprivation is rampant. And there's a tendency for people not to really realize that they have the problem because everyone around them is sleepy. And so they think, oh, there's nothing wrong with me if I get drowsy after lunch, or if I'm sitting in a boring meeting and I start getting sleepy because everybody else who isn't getting enough sleep is also getting sleepy. And so it just passes as normal.
Mm-hmm. Because everybody's sleep deprived.
Yeah, it seems like.
Yeah. So we're at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. If you've got a question for the sleep doctor, Dr. Sarah Stoltz, it's toll-free, 800-289-5869. You can write to us, conversation@kuow.org. Yeah, I've had sleepless nights, but I don't think I have a sleep disorder. What's the kind of a checklist we might want to go through to self-diagnose to see whether we want to check it out?
Well, I guess it's a feeling of whether you're rested or not. Sometimes I find in my visits with patients, I'm having to reassure them that something they have is normal. So I don't want to get the listeners too upset about the idea. Like when you first wake up in the morning, you're not necessarily going to be perfectly awake. But as the day goes on, you should be able to do quiet things without feeling drowsy. And especially if you're at all drowsy when you're driving, that's a huge red flag that there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the issues to do with sleep apnea. If you snore really loudly, maybe ask people if you ever seem like you stop breathing.
Is snoring, is there a level of snoring beyond which you should consider the fact that you might have sleep apnea, or is there a normal range of snoring?
Not necessarily. I don't think if you snore really, really loudly, you're probably more likely to have apnea, but just if you snore softly, it doesn't mean that you don't have it. And one big problem, Ross, is that people don't really know how loudly they snore because they're sleeping when it happens, and you're relying on the kindness of strangers to tell you, or maybe loved ones to tell you if you do.
Why is that? According to a well-informed source, I snore, but I don't wake myself up. What's up with that?
because you're asleep. And you know, you have to be awake for a little while before you really remember being awake. So here's a fun fact. We all wake up every night probably 5 or 10 times and have no recollection of it at all. Every time you roll over, if you look at the sleep in the sleep lab when we have all the wires on the head, we can see that the patient is awake, but they won't remember that. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, 15 seconds or something like that. So you could snore and wake yourself up and go right back to sleep and have no idea it happened.
Now, everybody's heard about the term insomnia, and I understand you talk to a lot of people who come in and just say they don't have they have insomnia. Is there a clinical definition of that?
Well, there'd be kind of four aspects to it: difficulty falling asleep, difficulty staying asleep, or waking up too early, and then a feeling that your sleep isn't restorative. So if you can only sleep 6 hours a night, but you feel perfectly fine during the day, we wouldn't label that as insomnia. And not everybody has all of those. You don't necessarily, it might be just a problem falling asleep, and then you sleep okay after that, or you wake up too early. But most of our patients are having both difficulty getting to sleep and difficulty maintaining sleep. They wake up a lot at night.
When does insomnia, the inability to get to sleep, to stay asleep, go from something that might be circumstantial? I mean, I know that if I'm nervous or stressed out, I have a hard time going to sleep. I think that's fairly common. At what point do you know that it's a symptom of a larger problem versus the problem itself?
Yeah. So it's sort of developed a life of its own. If you have a stressful event and you have trouble sleeping, we don't think that's unusual. But if past that point you're still having trouble sleeping, then something's wrong. And often it means that you've gotten into some maladaptive thinking. So you've developed expectations about not being able to sleep, or you've developed bad habits. You decided that you'd use the TV to put yourself to sleep, or go to bed early to get more sleep, or sleep in late, start varying your hours. And all of this then develops a different kind of insomnia that's a little harder to fix because you don't even realize that you're the one that caused it, in a sense.
That's so interesting. So you sort of convince yourself that you have insomnia, and that leads to you having more insomnia.
Right. So one bad experience, or maybe it's not one night, but you have a stressful job or a situation in your life where a loved one is ill or something, and you have night after night of trouble sleeping, you begin to believe that you can't sleep anymore. And it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy for some people.
You have the idea that you go to sleep when you're totally relaxed. A lot of people drink to get relaxed, so they must sleep really well.
No. One of the worst things you can do is drink right before you go to bed, and there's a number of reasons for that. The alcohol does make people drowsy. It's a very good sleeping pill in a sense that it puts a person to sleep, but it doesn't last very long. And then when it wakes up, wears off, it's almost like you've got a delayed action caffeine. It actually wakes you up as it wears off. And then the worst part is that it's a muscle relaxant. It causes relaxation of the tongue and the upper airway muscles, and so it can cause sleep apnea.
Now, what about marijuana? I mean, people use medical marijuana, and in the very not this distant future, many people will be using legal marijuana here. How does that affect sleep?
I think I'm going to be hearing a lot more about that coming up. It's not the best thing for sleep. It can reduce the deep sleep and the REM sleep. So, I mean, it does relax people. I don't think it causes sleep apnea.
We're at 206-543-5869. It's 800-289-5869. Write to us, conversation@kuow.org. Maybe you'd explain the connection between obesity and sleep. I think I've read places that if you don't get enough sleep, it can lead to obesity. Where is the chicken egg here?
Right. So we first got interested in obesity because we see a lot of overweight patients who have sleep apnea. But then it became apparent that there was a turn in the other direction, that not getting enough sleep can actually promote gaining weight. So if you sleep deprive normal, healthy volunteers, you'll find that they eat, I think it's about 500 calories more the next day, and they tend to crave junk food, you know, high calorie, salty, fatty foods. There's a change in the hormones that regulate appetite that causes people to feel more hungry, and their metabolism can be slower. So it's just a formula for gaining weight.
That's so interesting. So something about not getting enough sleep changes the hormone balance, and that in turn makes you hungry when maybe you don't really need food.
Right. Hmm. So then if you start gaining weight, then you can end up with sleep apnea and you're sleepy for two reasons.
Yeah. Well, one thing that we've all heard about is narcolepsy, and I understand an estimated 200,000 Americans suffer from it. And we might think of narcolepsy as I just fall asleep in the middle of this radio show because I, for some unknown reason, is that what narcolepsy is?
No. So a lot of patients and people on the street, I think they use the word narcolepsy as a synonym for sleepiness, which it's not. In our book, narcolepsy is a disorder. It's a medical condition, and it actually has a defined pathology to it. The symptoms of narcolepsy, the main one and the one you have to make a diagnosis of narcolepsy is sleepiness, but there can be some other symptoms which we can talk about if you like. The sleepiness that someone with narcolepsy has is extreme, and it's not made better by getting more sleep. That's the difference between a person with narcolepsy and a normal person. You can get refreshed if you don't have a sleep disorder by sleeping enough, but someone with narcolepsy, no matter how much they sleep, they're never really rested. They do get better with a short nap, but then it doesn't last that long. So it's an extreme sleepiness that you or I could experience if we kept ourselves up for several days. We'd also be sleepy just like that. It's not a magic kind of sleepiness where you're walking down the Ave and you collapse on the sidewalk like you might have seen in My Own Private Idaho. Did you ever see that movie?
Right, right. That was the main character in there had narcolepsy.
Yeah, and it's a very unrealistic portrayal of the disorder.
Why doesn't the sleep that revives most of us not revive a person with narcolepsy? Why doesn't it have the same impact?
That's a good question. There's something wrong in the brain's ability to maintain wakefulness in people with narcolepsy. So it's like there's a switch that allows you to flip from wake to sleep. And in narcolepsy, that switch is kind of broken, so it flips back and forth a lot. Whereas in a normal person, we have mechanisms that keep us stably in one state. And I could add a little science to that we sleep doctors think about the world as having three states, that a person could be awake, or they could be in REM sleep, or they could be in non-REM sleep. And those three are very, very different. Before I became a sleep doctor, I just thought wake and sleep, that's kind of like two things, but there's actually three. So in the person with narcolepsy, they have trouble maintaining the boundaries between those states so that they'll flip between wake and sleep, or sleep and wake, or also have little bits of REM sleep that'll show up when they're awake. So there's this symptom in narcolepsy called cataplexy, where if you experience a sudden rush of emotion, typically it's laughter, you can feel that your muscles become rubbery or weak, and you might even fall down. And that's because in REM sleep, we're ordinarily paralyzed, our muscles are very weak. And so that little bit of paralysis of REM sleep shows up in the middle of wakefulness for reasons we don't understand, triggered by emotion.
It's so interesting. You mentioned we can't maintain the boundaries between these types of sleep, which it's not a conscious maintenance. Is it something hormonal? What is it that should be regulating the different types of sleep?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure we understand exactly in narcolepsy. That we do know that there's a problem with cells in the hypothalamus that create a neurotransmitter called hypocretin, or some people call it orexin. And the narcoleptic human brain has shown that those cells are dying off, so they're not able to produce that chemical which keeps them awake. Whether that's also the one that keeps them from going into REM sleep is a little bit less clear.
I'm talking with Dr. Sarah Stoltz. She's the medical director of the sleep program at the Swedish Medical Center. We're at 206-543-5869. You can write to us, conversation@kuow.org. Chris is on the line. He's calling us today from Kirkland. Good afternoon, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. I was just wondering if you had any recommendations about sleep with jet lag. I've heard, things about going to bed earlier before the trip, but, in reality, that gets a little difficult. So do you have any other recommendations?
That's a really hard thing to answer because it has to do with how far you're going and what your schedule is in the new place versus the old place. So if it's just a matter of moving a few time zones, like you were going to the Midwest and maybe it's only 2 hours, you could maybe try to sleep on that new schedule at home, as you just suggested. You have trouble doing that, but go to bed a little earlier, get up a little bit earlier. Or you could try when you're at the new place to maintain your Seattle schedule. Other things that can help are melatonin and bright light. But it's difficult to give blanket advice because it depends on how far you're going. So if you're going to flip all the way, and go to Russia where it's 11 or 12 hour time zone change, you'd have to be very careful about when you used those kinds of stimuli.
Hey, Chris, thanks a lot for your phone call. I appreciate it. 206-543-5869. Write to us, conversation@kuow.org. Is there a natural sleep aid other than melatonin?
I would say that the best thing to help you sleep better is to have good sleep hygiene.
What's that mean?
Having good habits about your sleep. You know, dental hygiene is doing a good job of cleaning your teeth. So sleep hygiene means that you have good habits like keeping a regular schedule, going to bed and getting up at the same time every day, even weekends, maintaining a schedule that's the appropriate number of hours for you, not spending too much time in bed.
Why do I have to keep the same hours? I get up at 4:50 in the morning on the weekdays. I can't sleep in on the weekends.
Sorry, you have shift work sleep disorder.
Oh, no. And I shouldn't stay up really late on the weekends either.
You know, it's a matter of whether you are willing to accept the consequences of your own behavior, as it were. So if you have a bad schedule for work and we have sleep techs, okay? They work all night long. And they typically revert to a day schedule when they're not working. And it's not really very good for their system, but that's what they do. It's their choice. If you do what you do with your schedule, as long as you recognize that was a choice you made and you're maybe not going to feel as rested, and when it's time to go to bed the night before your first day back to work, you're probably going to have trouble. We call that Sunday night insomnia.
Can you time shift your sleep? In other words, I get home, I want to go out to a club at 10 o'clock, but I know that's going to push me way past my normal bedtime. Can I take a nap and then go out to that club at 10 o'clock and be okay with my sleep?
Some people can get away with that. Yeah. It really depends on the sleeper. I mean, some people are good at one thing and another. Some people are good sleepers and some people are bad sleepers. If you're a good sleeper, that might be a good strategy. But if you're somebody who tends toward insomnia, it might not work so well.
Rose wrote to us at conversation@kuow.org. She wants to know, what is restless leg and what's the connection to sleeplessness?
Yeah. Restless leg syndrome is a disorder that's got four criteria. There's a funny feeling in the legs, might be the arms, but it should be mostly the legs, that's like a creepy, crawly, nervous, anxious feeling that the key is that it causes you to feel that you have to move. So your legs are just like antsy. It should be something that comes on when you're at rest, so you're sitting or you're lying in bed. It's made better by movement. So when you're moving your legs, the feeling should go away. It might come back again as soon as you sit still again. And then it's worse in the evening. Restless leg should not be confused with periodic limb movements of sleep. This is something I run into a lot, that when you're sleeping, your legs can move involuntarily every 20, 30, 40 seconds, just a little movement, or maybe it's a big movement, but can happen over and over and over again a good deal of the night. And that may or may not mean anything. If you have restless legs, it's quite likely you'll have those movements, but it's not the same thing as restless legs. So when someone comes in and says, well, my husband has restless legs, I'm always suspicious that they're actually talking about those leg movements that happen during sleep.
Dr. Sarah Stoltz, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. We've been talking about sleep disorders with the medical director of the sleep program at Swedish Medical Center. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.